The China in Africa podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Africa-China Reporting Project at Wits University in Johannesburg. The ACRP promotes balanced, considered reporting on China-Africa relations through training programs held throughout the year. More information at africachinareporting.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the China in Africa podcast, a proud member of the Seneca Podcast Network. I'm Eric Olander, and as always, I'm joined by CGSP's Africa editor, Jeronima, from the beautiful island of Mauritius. A very good afternoon to you, Jero.
Good afternoon to you, Eric.
Wonderful to have you back on the show. Very busy week this week. This is the week that Angolan President João Lourenço is in China. He's going to be meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping. He's also going to be with the Premier Li Qiang. A very short visit compared to other African leaders who've been going to China for 6, sometimes 7 days, these long trips. He's only going to be on the ground for 3.5 days. He's going to start in Beijing, and then he's going to make his way to Shandong province. This is an important visit, Jero, for a number of different reasons. We're going to get into Shandong and why that was an interesting choice, and it's very different than the itinerary of previous African heads of state who've started their trips in Shenzhen and then made their way up to Shanghai to the New Development Bank and then eventually kind of make their way to Beijing with oftentimes other stops along the way. Lourenço is going from Beijing to Shandong and then back to Luanda. So it comes at an interesting time when Angola is right smack in the middle of the great power rivalry between the United States and China. That's the part of this trip that you're focusing on the most.
Yes, exactly. That's a part I'm going to be covering this week and maybe the next week as well on the geopolitical parts of that trip. It's really how João Lourenço is really playing his cards smart. Mind you, a few months back in December, he was in DC talking about billions of dollars for the Benguela Railway, the Lobito project that we've been talking about from the US and the European. And this week is going to be going to Beijing. We know he's going to meet Xi Jinping, and hopefully we're going to have some agreement. Are we going to see what MOUs or real agreement? We don't know yet, but we are seeing that's happening. And something that's really quite interesting is going to be arriving in Beijing, not as really a beggar, I would say, comparing to other African head of state. He's going to be coming there with a very much strong position than his other counterpart, because he's coming there knowing that I already get $1 billion from the US. I'm having a very strong US interest there. So he knows that the way he's going to be talking to Xi Jinping or to any other counterpart, any Chinese companies or Chinese official, he knows that he can talk in the position of strength, much more confident in what he has and what he can get from that. But let's not forget, Angola and China is still $18 billion of debt that needs to be addressed. So we're going to see if all those topics are going to be part of the conversation. And we're also going to see how China is going to address his presence there and what they can put on the table. Are they going to slap him with some MOUs? I'd say, I wouldn't say invaluable MOUs, but some just like some protocol or MOUs are they really going to propose some strong dinners on the table? You talked about Shandong. I was quite curious to see, what do you make of his trip to Shandong? Of all the places he could have gone, why did he pick Shandong to go to?
Yeah, it's not the obvious choice. The obvious choice would have been Shenzhen, where that's the headquarters of Huawei and Transsion, these tech companies. Shanghai is also the major finance and commercial hub. That's, again, where they've gone. Shandong is an interesting choice. A lot of people were asking me yesterday my take on why Shandong. And let's not forget, Shandong is one of China's wealthiest provinces. It has a $1.3 trillion GDP just for that province alone. That puts it in the class of a major country in many respects, a trillion plus GDP. It's got a major port in the form of Qingdao. Also, it's the headquarters of some very large Chinese state companies that are active in Africa. Hisense and Haier are two in particular that have very big operations in South Africa. These are electronics and white goods makers. And the most important reason, though, Jero, is that Shandong is this northeast. Oftentimes, it has this reputation of being the rust belt of China. It's heavy in steel manufacturing, auto manufacturing. It used to be a very dirty province in terms of pollution. But this is one of the manufacturing hubs of the world. And if a country like Angola wants to move up that value chain and wants to start industrializing and adding more manufacturing into the mix and to just not export oil anymore, then this is the place to go. And these are the relationships to make. So hard to tell if it was a push or a pull, if it was Zhao Lorenzo's team who said, we want to go to Shandong, or if it was the Chinese who said, let's introduce you to Shandong.
It can be both.
Could be both. Also want to kind of bring everybody's attention who haven't been following this very closely, but Shandong has been one of those provinces that's starting to be a lot more active in the China-Africa relationship. Back in 2020, they hosted a Shandong-Kenya trade expo where they brought 93 companies over to Nairobi. And then in 2023, they did something similar where they brought companies over as well. So the Shandong provincial government is part of this shift that's happening in the China-Africa relationship where subnational actors, that is not the central government in Beijing, is starting to play a much more prominent role in driving this relationship. Giraud, the timing of Lorenzo's visit is very interesting because he's going at a period when the Chinese economy is really having some difficulties. And I saw a fascinating statistic today that the number of data points that the Chinese are releasing about their economy has just cratered. And that's a reflection that the bad news is coming fast and furious, whether it's in the property market, whether it's in the quantity of FDI coming into the country. Unemployment rates are quite high. There's a massive debt problem at the provincial level as well. So this is really going to be very interesting for Lorenzo to see this up close and personal. And it's really perfect timing for this article that came out just a couple of weeks ago. Is there a silver lining for Africa in China's slowdown? And it was written by our old friend of the program, Jude Moore, who is a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, also a former minister in Liberia, and host of the fantastic podcast Lagos to Mombasa. We roused him up early this morning to join us on the show today. And Jude, it's been a while, so welcome back to the show.
Eric, it's great being back on the show. It's incredible talking to you and Gerard. Gerard, it's really nice meeting you. It's a pleasure being here. You do really good work covering this space, expanding it beyond Africa, but mainly in Africa, a lot of people find great value in the work you do. So it's great being back on the show.
Well, you know, just very humbled to get that from someone like you. We really appreciate your time and we're really looking forward to this wide-ranging conversation that we're going to have today. I'd like to get your take on the economy and on your article about the silver lining. But before we dive into that, you were just in China yourself. You're going to be going back again. You were in Beijing. You were teaching there for a few months. I'd just like to get your take on what it was like for you to be there. And it had been a decade since you were last there. And so what were some of your observations about what had changed and where we are today, particularly as someone who looks at the relationship with China, both from an African perspective, but also given the fact that you've been based in the United States for so long and are so fluent in U.S. politics? How did you see all of those worlds in Beijing coming together?
Thank you, Eric. It was an incredible experience. And I think, you know, for most people who do get an opportunity to visit China, you should. Normally, I start by saying that, you know, in the 1960s, infant mortality in China was worse than it is in the worst country today in the world. And that's Afghanistan. That's how bad, that's how poor China was. And to come from that depth to become now the second largest economy in the world, it's a $17 or $18 trillion economy. It is absolutely incredible. First time I went to China, I went as a part of a government delegation. By then, Hu Jintao was the president of China. Our delegation met with President Xi, but by then he was vice president. And coming back now, the first time I was there, of course, because I was with a government delegation, everything was sort of coordinated and curated. We had leaders everywhere we went. We're political people. Now, coming back to China as a private citizen and being free to move around, it is just really incredible that the things that impressed you 10 years ago are now old news and there are more things to impress you. But I think what stands out for an African coming to China is always going to be the quality and availability of public infrastructure and how the entire country is crisscrossed with superior infrastructure network, which translates into superior logistics for Chinese firms, making them really, really competitive when it comes to manufacturing. And then there's just this scale of the manufacturing. There can be a company in Guizhou, there can be a company in Inner Mongolia, and it's still going to be competitive because of the quality of the logistics network. And so I think it was an eye-opener. And for any African policymaker coming to China, you're going to be thinking to yourself, how did it do it? What can we learn? what is adaptable, what isn't. And I think that a lot of Africans, a lot of government officials and policymakers coming to China, this is what is inspiring them. This is what they're thinking about. And so for me, just having been there, being in Beijing, gotta remember I'm from Liberia. Our population is like 5 million and Beijing is like 21 million people. And so they have like 19 different subway lines. It's just insane. But it was an incredible experience for me. Great food, great people, and then a beautiful country, continent-sized country. You have desert, you have snow, you have tropical climate in the south. It's like, oh, it was beautiful. It was beautiful. And I think, you know, outside the great power rivalry, there's a lot to enjoy in China. But I would just add then, seeing China through the eyes of a U.S. policymaker, I tried to put myself in that position. The interstate system in the U.S. was built in the 1950s as a means of expanding an U.S. military access to the country. It allows the movement of materiel and men in times of war. So if you're a U.S. policymaker and you're looking at China, you're probably thinking the same thing. And I can see where China's rise, China's massive industrial capability that is expanding, you can see where the fear comes in the West when they look at China and China rising.
Jude, you said something very interesting there, where you say you've put yourself in a position where you want to see things from the U.S. policymakers. But in the same time, your background, your personal life, you're really from an African perspective. So when you've been in China, when you see those changes, when you see what has happened in the last 30, 40 years in China, do you kind of now understand from an African perspective why, when there is that China bashing narrative that's coming from the US to in Africa, sometimes is met with sheer, like, you know, skeptical looks, and people are kind of just being polite and nodding head without really committing to those kind of narrative. Do you see now where, do you kind of understand where those African perspectives are coming from? And now from the US perspective, do you get the sense where they kind of understand why Africans are reacting the way they react when they talk to them about China?
Yeah, I think if you follow my work, this is the distinction when it comes to thinking and talking about Africa, at least from my perspective here in U.S. policymaking circles and in this discourse. I've always been clear that the continent has unique interests that diverge from American ones, which would be different in how it perceives China. And the visit there was a confirmation, an affirmation of that, to such an extent that I would argue that going forward, the way Africans see China and engage China will always be different from the way Americans see China and the way they engage China. And consequently, it is going to be this matching, this delicate balance between the two sides about finding common ground on what it's like. And I think if you listen to American policymakers, Secretary of State Blinken, since he became Secretary of State, he's been really, really careful not to sort of couch the relationship between the United States and Africa presented through a Chinese lens. He's done a really, really good job intentionally trying not to do that. And there are American policymakers now who I think are beginning to grasp how different this is and trying to sort of navigate that relationship. So yeah, I think there is a change. Now, every now and then, you're still going to hear debt trap diplomacy. Every now and then, you're still going to hear some of the same accusations, but I think to a certain extent, there is a realization of the qualitative aspects of the relationship between the continent and China.
We're going to hear from some of those policymakers later in the show, because last week was a Senate Armed Services hearing on Capitol Hill that featured General Michael Langley, who is the head of AFRICOM. And we're going to get Giraud and also Jude's response to some of the question and answer there. Again, the tone has changed and we'll hear that tone change. But let's go to your article now about this silver lining. This is a little bit contrarian, a little bit counterintuitive, because the news that we cover is that the downturn in China has a direct negative impact on many African countries who sell the Chinese raw materials. The price of commodities is in many cases at historic lows. We're looking at cobalt, lithium, nickel. These are all in rock bottom prices. Oil is kind of fluctuating. So it's not always intuitive that what's happening in China would have a silver lining for Africa. Give us the headline. Give us the elevator pitch of your article, and then we'll dive into it about what is this silver lining that you're reading into the China-Africa relationship while the Chinese economy is having some difficulties.
Yeah, so I think first I should establish, I agree with you, that it is a difficult time for Africa and African economies. It was out of this bad situation. This is a bad situation. The IMF just released this paper, something called Understanding the Evolving Landscape of China-Africa Relations.
And by the way, that was a great paper. That was rock star. We'll put it in the show notes, but that one was I don't know the people who did this one, but they did a fantastic job.
It is an excellent paper, and I think it lays bare Africa's exposure to any downturn in China, and especially for the commodity exporters. But you have to go back to 2022. The UNCTAD released a report that showed like 83% of African countries depend on commodities for most of their revenue, that 45 out of the 54 economies depend on commodity exports for more than 60% of revenue. And because of the size and scale of China's appetite over the last 20 years, most of that has been going to China. So automatically, Africa's commodity exporters with their undifferentiated, undiversified export baskets are squarely in the value chain of Chinese corporations. And so any slowdown in China has immediate and negative impacts in Africa. So I want to start off by saying it is a bad situation. But then I step back for a minute to think like, look, it is a bad situation, but is there a silver lining here? Are there things that African economies can take advantage of because of the circumstances we find ourselves in today? And so this is the pitch that I've made. And the first one is that after China shut down because of the COVID and zero COVID policy, it became clear how China-centric global value chains were. And so most big manufacturers, most big companies around the world adapted this China plus one strategy, right? You have China, but then you start doing stuff in Malaysia, Indonesia, or Vietnam. But because of tensions in the South China Sea and American military people always saying that China intends to take Taiwan back between 2027 and 2035 or 2030, then companies began to shift to a China plus 10 strategy, right? And so I argue that places in Latin America and places in Africa have an opportunity to make a substantive bid to be one of the plus 10. So countries, the continent's relatively stable economies that have made investment in infrastructure, your Cote d'Ivoire, Kenya, Zambia, maybe this is an opportunity for them to make a bid for a stake in global value chains. But I also know that Europe, the United States, Japan, Korea are doing everything they can to move themselves out of Chinese value chains for critical minerals. China so dominates that space that it is important for them that take Australian wine, or China has now canceled grain imports from the US, right? So you're thinking like, what if China decides to do the same with critical minerals? It's time to move out of Chinese value chain. And then you're seeing them move to Africa at exactly the moment when Zimbabwe and Namibia are saying, we're not exporting raw lithium anymore. Beneficiation has to happen at home. I'm saying here's an opportunity now for African economies to make a pitch to be that second value chain that is differentiated from the Chinese one. So the idea then, I guess the elevator pitch was that you can always flip all of these things over because crises also present opportunities. And for African economies facing a difficult time, maybe it's time to look for the opportunities that are possible here. The final thing that I say in the piece is, well, penultimate, is that because China has been such a dominant market, most African commodity exporters have not put in the hard work to develop alternate markets. And so it meant that when China was booming, everybody was booming. And the slowdown in China meant you had no options outside of China. So maybe it's time for African commodity exporters to imagine their own China plus one or China plus two strategy in developing markets elsewhere, whether it's in India, in Vietnam, in Latin America, or in parts of Central and Eastern Europe. But this was the gist of my piece that, yes, it is a difficult situation, but is it possible to squeeze these lemons and turn them into a bit of lemonade?
Interesting point here on the China plus one. So Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the president of the Philippines, is in Germany this week as Germany's trying to diversify away from China. Also last week, the Australians convened a summit with ASEAN leaders. So this new focus on Southeast Asia is something that other countries are doing. We don't see that focus in Africa right now, looking to the 600-700 million consumers who are here where I'm at in Southeast Asia presents a huge opportunity for African countries. Let's talk, Géraud, very quickly. One of the issues that Jude brings up in his piece is about African governments are not without agency and influencing the new reality. You and I were talking before we went on the air about how Guinea is a great example of how an African country leveraged great power rivalries to get what it wanted. Maybe you can talk about that, and then we can talk about this question of how African countries can play the great powers off each other, much the same way that João Lourenço seems to be doing in Angola as well.
Yeah, what's has transpired or what's happened in Guinea is quite commendable and amazing to see in every aspect that you can think of the topic. We have here Mamadi Doumbouya, who 4 years ago was an unknown person. He was a military, and he makes a coup in Guinea in September 2011. And when he took power, we saw how Beijing kind of reacted. It was the first time we saw Beijing reacted kind of vehemently to push back onto what was happening there. And we saw that they were kind of worried about that. And later on, we saw Doumbouya managing, being able to come to put Rio Tinto's China Alco, Baoustil that joined later on the same table to say, you guys, you have to come together to find the way to develop the Simandou project and to build the infrastructure that I need for you to export this iron ore from Simandou. And he did that in a way that people were not expecting him to do that. Let's face it, he's a transitional president. He's going to be there for, it's been 3 years now, and people were not expecting him to really go further in that direction. We even bet that he was going to fail. But somehow, he managed to create the condition to put them back together on the same table and to force them to come to an agreement. And let's face it, he had on his side the opportunity to have that Australia-China's trade tension over the COVID accusation and all the geopolitical accusation in the global south there. But he really managed to play that card very smartly in a way that at the end, he got what he wanted. And today we have Rio Tinto and winning groups together and China Cobalt still all together in the same table, making a joint venture that's going to develop the Simandou project and the iron infrastructure that's going to come with it. We are talking about a 1997 project. It's been years that people have been sitting on that, and to see that taking shape and form today, it's something quite amazing. And the way Guinea has managed to do that is commendable.
Yeah. So, but this issue, Jude, about moving up the critical mineral value chain, we've been hearing a lot about it. You've talked about it. It sounds great. But let me just bring you to a headline from this week that really speaks to the big problem. Zambia's Chambishi copper smelter scales back capacity amid power cuts. And this is the China Nonferrous Metal Mining Corporation, CNMC. They're one of the largest mining corporations in the world. They've built a lot of hydroelectric dams in Zambia and in Zimbabwe, and they're having drought. And so there is an energy deficit in many parts of southern Africa. The big problem is that it requires a lot of infrastructure in order to do the processing. There is a second challenge here, though. China's not the friend that they may think it is in this respect, because China subsidizes large parts of its processing industry of critical minerals, either through discounted electricity, discounted water, all sorts of different things. And that makes it very difficult for countries in Africa that won't enjoy those subsidies to be able to be price competitive. So how are these countries going to do this without enough infrastructure and facing this giant competitor that is not going to give up processing easily and shed market share?
Well, so this is one of the points that I make. The smelting of ores, the conversion of an ore to from a mineral taken out of the earth and converting it to a metal, requires significant amounts of power, of electricity, and that electricity has to be affordable, has to be really cheap. And so matching China, again, I spoke of the superior logistics and the superior industrial capacity. This is going to be very, very difficult. But I think there is an opportunity here for those who explore it. And the reason I say this is that the only reason Simandou became viable was because of Chinese actions on Australian ore. So for a very long time, and Gerard notes, since 1997, it had become sort of an article of faith in Guinean political economy that Guinean ore, Guinean resources over Guinean territory. So tying a rail and a deep sea port in Conakry to the exploitation of the minerals in Simandou has always been a part of this thing in Guinea, to such an extent that many of the purely commercial enterprises that attempted to develop it understood that they didn't think that it would be viable commercially. So every single person who's come to Simandou has tried to use Liberia, because the port of Bikana is closer than, say, Conakry. But once China took the action it did with Australian ore, then it changed the calculus of the project. So I guess the point that I'm making is there is a possibility here that whether it's the United States, whether it's Europe or Korea, they might be able to pay a premium if it means that they're no longer dependent on Chinese value chains. And there would be an opportunity here for the investment in infrastructure that would be required to do it. But to Gerard's point, the African governments themselves have to imagine and see it. It means that you're going to have to make some sacrifices. And are they willing and ready to make those sacrifices? I do not know. But what I do know is right now in Zimbabwe, there is a first layer of beneficiation of lithium. Almost all of that beneficiation has been done by Chinese firms, right? So it's not European, it's not American, it's not Korean. And so the countries that seemingly supposedly want to pivot outside of Chinese value chains still do not have a substantive presence in that space in Africa. And so is there a possibility? Yeah, in the universe of possibilities, that is, but it's not going to be easy. And that's why I think maybe it doesn't make sense for countries to try to do this on their own. Maybe there is some sort of consortium of you know, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Zambia, South Africa, and they create a hub in which there's joint investment in infrastructure, and they create this place where it's processed, sort of create a zone, and they all benefit from it. But I think if each of them tries to go their own way, the amount of resources it would take for the investment make it probably push this beyond their capacity.
What you mentioned is really something that we've been seeing, and we've been complaining about that among the experts, those who follow the topic, is the notice that the challenge that you're mentioning are regional challenges that can find solution if those countries pull resources together and pull strategies together in a way that they can address them. And it's even funnier, especially when you see that the same Chinese companies are the one roaming the region in different countries. The way they approach those countries, as long as Zhejiang Huayou Cobalt, for example, will be approaching Namibia, Zimbabwe or DRC as one, in a much more one specific entity, knowing that he has one strategy in the region, Zimbabwe, Namibia and DRC will be approaching Zhejiang Huayou Cobalt as a single country. And you find themselves in a situation where they are unable to pull a strategy, a current strategy where they can really win in that regard to China. And that's where we've been having those complaints a lot, where we see how South Africa, DRC, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Namibia, Mozambique, to create that hub of critical mineral resources hub where they can really put resources together and strategies together where they can really win and leverage their position with China and the rest of the world. The reality is the national politics inside kind of mess up the whole game for all of them because they have different group of interests that really complicate all the strategy they can put together.
Yes and no, gentlemen. Yes and no, because we've started to see the first kind of green shoots between Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi working very closely with Zambian President Haike Ndeshilema on the supply chains. I mean, they're having those discussions at least, right?
Let me have those caveat on that. The case has been shown recently, DRC and Zambia. There was a report that was published like a few weeks back that shows you the discussion where the DRC wanted the industry, the processing part to be built on its side. Zambia wanted to be built on its side. And the both countries now, they find themselves in dispute because they do not agree where they should build the processing side. You have those kind of dispute because each country, they do know that the kind of revenues and the kind of political leverage they will pull out of those kind of infrastructure for their own politic inside is massive. So they cannot just allow to make those kind of concessions. So that's why I said the internal politics make a regional approach almost difficult, if not impossible, in this stage of the process.
There is a universe in which, you know, part of the reason is, like you're saying, all of those countries need jobs, right? Especially the DRC, you need jobs. All of those countries, they need infrastructure. And so for one country to give up being the destination for this hub, it's going to be very difficult. However, if the countries come together and hire a third party to design what is the most effective and efficient way that ends up being mutually beneficial, that will happen. I think, though, you know, you're having these kinds of conversations happening on the continent now. The AfCFTA is moving forward, not as fast as we would like, but it is moving forward. And I think it's becoming clearer and clearer to Africans. There's a report that came out in UNECA that showed that intra-Africa trade remains really, really low, that Africans continue to trade, you know, for the most part, with the rest of the world at significantly higher levels than they do with each other. And so maybe what's happening in China today, what's happening in the world today, the bifurcation of trade and investment, this what the IMF is calling geoeconomic fragmentation, maybe it will force African countries to get to this point. But I think you're right that the difficulty of internal politics and the inability of countries to at least, you know, make concessions in terms of designing this might stand in the way of benefiting from the silver lining that I see in what's happening today.
Well, let's talk about one of these case studies, which is the Lobito Corridor. That's been all the talk in Washington. They're setting up a billion-dollar refurbishment of the 1,067-kilometer Benguela Railway that goes from the, correct me if I'm wrong here on my geography, guys, from the northern cobalt belt in the DRC to the southern copper belt in Zambia, all the way across Angola to the port of Lobito on the Atlantic Ocean. The idea is this is going to be a mineral express, but they also want to build businesses and small enterprises along the corridor. They've talked about green hydrogen. In typical American fashion, there's just a huge amount of ambition. This thing does seem to be moving forward. That said, we saw a report last week from Africa Intelligence, which generally is very reliable on these things. And I'd love to get your take on this, Jude. The African Intelligence story says U.S. reluctant to finance Angola-Zambia extension of Lobito Corridor Railways. They did not cite any sources in the story. It's the first time that I have heard about U.S. hesitation on this project. They've been all in up until now. What's your take on the Lobito Corridor and what the U.S. is doing? And do you think that the U.S. can pull it off, especially because this is a multi-year project? And we're a 50-50 chance right now from Donald Trump coming back into power later this year. So what's your take on this and where U.S. politics are?
It seems to me that both the Americans and the Europeans have a lot riding on this. So much stake on this that this is the Wall Street Journal running this piece of how the U.S. is now fighting back against China and countering China in Africa when it comes to infrastructure. Every speech American policymakers make on substantive U.S. presence on the continent, Lobito Corridor comes up. The project has always presented difficulties outside of just the talking points. Most of the mines that will benefit from that corridor are probably Chinese owned, right? And so because they have been the most active in the region, and even as we speak, there is an agreement now. We don't know if it's going to materialize, but there's an agreement for the refurbishment of Tazara. So maybe, you know, this was supposed to be the big statement from the United States that is not ceding ground to China when it comes to infrastructure in Africa and it's working with African governments. So I think there is enough political will here, at least from what I'm hearing and seeing here in Washington, to ensure that this project goes through. It seems to be on the European side. Global Gateway is also pushing Lobito Corridor as one of its big projects in combination. So it's sort of like a combination of PGRI and Global Gateway led by both the Americans and the Europeans. And there seems to be a significant amount of political will to make this happen. Now, if the former President Trump gets elected, who knows? I do know, however, that Mark Esper, the former defense secretary under President Trump, wrote a book in which he argued that Trump at one point considered shutting down every American embassy in Africa.
And he wanted to kill AFRICOM too, by the way.
And one of the ways they talked him out of it was saying doing that means China wins. So it is possible that the same argument holds here, that this was supposed to be how we deal with the Chinese in Africa, and walking away from this project means that Africa wins. So there is a lot of uncertainty, and that's why I think because of the specter of the return of a Trump administration, or for a lot of African governments, even when the Biden administration came to power, it was always going to be cautiously optimistic in a wait and see attitude, because Trump continues to loom over it all as a possible departure from everything that is happening now.
And don't forget that Trump was also instrumental in creating the Development Finance Corporation, which originally started as OPIC. I forget what the acronym stands for. But that was done under the Trump administration to inject $60 billion into development finance that the United States had not done before. Why? Because they wanted to confront China. So you're right. It's entirely possible that projects like the Lobito Corridor continue even if broader U.S. engagement with Africa declines. Let's now get the pulse of some of the rhetoric that you were talking about inside the Beltway. And I want to bring everybody to what happened last week on Capitol Hill, as I mentioned, in the Senate Armed Services Committee. Now, every year, the commanders from all the regional theaters of operation, that's CENTCOM, AFRICOM, SOUTHCOM, go up to Capitol Hill. They meet with a couple of different committees, the Armed Services Committee in both the House and the Senate, and also the Appropriations Committee. And the Appropriations Committees are the important ones because they have the checkbook. And so in years past, this has been an exercise in these generals kind of laying out the threats of the world, oftentimes in a way to terrify senators and representatives into giving them a lot more money. This year was a little bit different, though, and this is what I'm really curious to get both of your reaction. U.S. Marine Corps General Michael Langley, who is the head of U.S. forces in Africa, he gave the 2024 U.S.-Africa Command what they're calling posture testimony, and he was joined by U.S. Army General Michael Carrilla, who is the commander of CENTCOM. CENTCOM is Central Command, which is the Middle East, South Asia, and I'm missing another part of that, I think in the Mediterranean area. Let's start with some of the opening remarks by Mississippi Senator Roger Wicker. He is the highest ranking Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee. And Jude, I want to get your take on the themes that he raised to General Langley about the Chinese in Africa.
China and Russia view the African continent as a power projection platform. They use the region to flex their muscles, undermine Western influence, and bolster their economic interest. Beijing and Moscow do all this through exploitative practices that often come at the expense of African communities. China, in particular, approaches Africa as a critical terrain for its global military expansion. Its first overseas military base was established in the strategically located country of Djibouti. According to public reports, this base is now capable of hosting some of China's most advanced naval vessels. Additionally, we know China is actively pursuing a naval base on Africa's Atlantic coast. General Langley has said this would, quote, change the whole calculus of the geostrategic campaign plans of protecting our homeland.
Okay, there's the reference to the base. Also, I just want to be very clear for our listeners who don't understand U.S. politics. These senators do not represent the voice of the U.S. government. That's the executive branch. But they do represent the discourse that's happening in Washington. Jude, what did you hear in Senator Wicker's comments?
Well, I think when Jake Sullivan made a speech at Georgetown outlining the new U.S. national security strategy, he captured these themes too. That U.S. national security strategy is in two strands now. One is this geoeconomic, geopolitical rivalry with China in terms of determining whose ideas shape the world going forward for the next 50 years. And the second is geopolitical, just global problems like pandemics and climate change and things like that. So what you're hearing there is a reflection of the first one. In a great power competition, an advantage for one is seen as a loss for the other. And so any increase in Chinese influence on the continent is perceived as coming at a loss of American influence and coming at America's expense. So the second thing is there's always been this trend that somehow Africans are getting the terrible deal that someone needs to protect them from the sneaky and conniving Chinese. Right? And you hear that again, that is most times it's at the expense of Africans and you. And then finally, there's this issue with the military. I think, you know, if you have invested at least $150 billion in two decades, if you have some a third in 2019 of the manufacturing on the continent has been done by Chinese firms, if you have the expansion of all the digital capacity on the continent coming through ZTE or Huawei, and if more than 40% of African handsets are being used as transient handsets, If you have that amount of economic investment in a space, it doesn't seem out of order or crazy that you will begin to think of ways to protect that. So you hear that, and this is very, very evident everywhere, that one, China's growing influence on the continent is both hurting Africans, but it's coming at the expense of American influence. What can and what should be done about that? I think what he's saying is very reflective of what you hear here when people think and talk about China, especially in Africa.
Gero, what did you hear?
I heard an American policymaker that's kind of afraid that present the situation in his very zero-sum game position where, as Judas said, Africa needs to be protected. I'd say the tone was a bit even patronizing, that they said it so much they don't realize how the narrative is perceived from an African perspective, to say that if I welcome China, if I even think of hosting a China base in my country, somehow I'm putting myself in danger or I'm hurting anyone else. And that, I think, it's kind of patronizing in a way that they not understand the leverage and the agenda that African country can have. A few days ago, I was having that discussion, saying to people that it's any point in time when an Atlantic coast African country would raise the idea that, you know, we may have a China base here, every bells will ring in Washington and say, we need to do something there. At the end, you kind of wonder, like, if they really want to engage in Africa for Africa's sake or for much more China's sake. And the last story was related to Gabon, when President Ali Bongo, the former president, said that, I've formally just said that, like verbally said that, you know, to a US diplomat in Libreville, that, you know, I've give President Xi my commitment that maybe can build a base in Libreville. Just that statement led the US security apparatus flying over Gabon, meeting Ali Bongo, talking to him. And when he was ousted, meeting his successor, talking to him, trying to move them away from that discussion. That's friction, that kind of friction they do have, kind of make them oblivious to the idea that African country do have a certain amount of leverage they can also use for their own advantage, for their own interest. So if they don't see that way, I think they're going to miss the point. They're going to have so many blind spots, they're going to be surprised of the final result at the end.
So interestingly, General Langley, who has brought up the base issue previously, did not mention it once in this testimony. General Langley, who has also been a trafficker of the debt trap narrative, did not mention that too in this testimony. So the general was much more constrained in his remarks. Maybe, Gero, maybe it's because they are reading what we're writing. And we have some subscribers inside the DOD, and we've been very critical of the DOD over the years for this whole base theory, which we've contended is more about Washington budgetary politics than actual military issues. One thing just to keep in mind, and this was given a piece of information to me from a military analyst in Washington who said, the Chinese cannot have a base in West Africa because there is no country that can provide the force protection that's needed. Whereas the United States will have its own soldiers that go around to protect its bases. Chinese soldiers cannot put their foot on foreign soil without violating the non-interference doctrine. So they require the host country to provide the base protection and the force protection. That is the fundamental reason why this analyst does not believe that there is ever a prospect for a Chinese base in West Africa. Let's continue on with our discussion on what General Langley was saying. Now we're going to hear a question from Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville, who wanted to know in very broad terms from General Langley how the United States can better compete with China in Africa.
China has been investing in economic infrastructure developments in Africa since the 90s. What are the operational advantages that China has over our efforts in Africa, and what are we doing to help out on that?
So, Senator, right now, China has a plan, a long-range plan, but they're coming in with their Belt and Road initiatives. But I think they do have global aspirations for a security construct to get a decisive advantage over the United States. We need activities and investments to deter that. Especially engaging with our partners, our African partners, and telling them to ensure that they're not militarized. So this takes an information campaign that's successful, but also assurance actions of building partnership and capacity where they won't need China in their false offerings of security construct.
Apologies for those of you wearing headphones and listening to the pop on that microphone. That is the general doing that, not us. Jude, how would you assess the general's answers?
This is not the first time this question is being discussed. And I usually try to explain that the U.S. is actually doing a lot in Africa. I think PEPFAR is an important thing. You can't have a conversation in Africa without PEPFAR, PMI. It comes back to the questions that, to what we discussed at the beginning. The way Africa sees China engages in China is going to be completely different. And whether China has global aspirations or not, that's not the context in which the continent engages China. What does Chad care about China's global aspirations if they're building a power plant in Chad? You know, what does Guinea-Bissau care if China is trying to project its force projection outside of Asia if they're building a water filtration plant? I think part of the difficulty for Americans is that they have had all of the infrastructure they need for such a long time that it is almost impossible to imagine a world in which the infrastructure isn't as ready. It's almost taken for granted as one takes air for granted. Whereas in a lot of African countries, even the developed ones like South Africa, infrastructure remains an issue. You're going 6 hours, 8 hours without power. So in South Africa, and this is the continent's most complex economy. I think in the end, Eric, it comes back to this question about interests. Every conversation you hear, the hearings you hear, what the general is saying, what the senator is saying is about how do we advance and protect and project American interests. That is the exact same question is being asked from the African side. And for them, the answer is closer ties to China, working with China. Now, if it is possible for the U.S. to sort of best China in those places, fine. But the U.S. doesn't do direct G2G lending the way the Chinese do. The new DFC is attempting to close that gap, but the new DFC is not lending directly to governments. And this is something the Chinese continue to do. And as long as that space remains, then it's going to be very, very difficult for the United States to match the Chinese in the mode of operation in Africa. And they're going to have to find other ways of being able to establish, you know, this material American presence in the economic sphere.
Giraud, I'd like to get your take now on the last soundbite that we're going to get from General Langley. This is coming from a question from Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth, who incidentally also serves on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. That's one of the rarities when somebody's on both Senate Armed Services and Foreign Relations. That makes her quite powerful. And she wanted to know what General Langley thought the U.S. can do better to challenge Chinese influence in Africa. And Giraud, I'd like to get your take because this touches on some of the key issues that Jude talked about regarding PEPFAR.
We continue to see increasing PRC investments in the CENTCOM and AFRICOM AORs that involve economic, diplomatic, and military activity. This poses a threat to our national security, requiring strategic coordination across the interagency. So we must also leverage our allies and partners to counter this PRC activity. General Carrillo and General Langley, can you explain the importance of DOD working across the interagency, especially with the State Department and USAID, to counter malign PRC activity in your AORs? And how can Congress help you?
Thanks for that question, Senator. And so collectively at our headquarters, we have representation across the interagency and also USAID and the Department of State. And collectively, when we campaign with our African partners, we take this into effect. We do this to counter, one, the information space. There's a number of things by Russia and China that are pushing and shaping onto our African partners, especially across their society, that changes ways and a departure away from international norms. So what we're doing is with activities and investments across USAID and the State Department to employ type of efforts that are unmatched, such as in global health. Strategic health is unmatched, but what? Just one thing. When I was with Minister Councilor Mara Berry, we went to Zambia because we knew that they had already put out information about the helicopters that we delivered there for crisis response were all about fighting a war. That was a skewed message. But what it was, I was with Minister Councilor Berry, and she says, "Hey, tell what the numbers for PEPFAR are about. We saved 25 million lives. We increase the life expectancy by 20 years. when we started this 20 years ago with President Bush. This was, and others that supported these Congresses supporting funding of PEPFAR. That's something that's unmatched by our competitors.
Some of our younger listeners may be wondering, what the heck is this PEPFAR thing? Okay, so I think I need to kind of see this, because when you ask a lot of Americans, say, give me the most innovative policy that the Americans have had in Africa, just give me anything you've got. And invariably, PEPFAR comes up. And PEPFAR, okay, here we go again, acronyms, Presidential Emergency Fund for AIDS Relief. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
So it's anti-HIV and it provides antiretroviral medications. You know, Jiro, when I'm listening to this, I'm thinking to myself, the United States is the only country in the world where it allows its generals to sit in public and talk about anything. You will never hear a French general talk about French development assistance like this, or a Japanese general, or even a Chinese general, anyone. There is no other country in the world that has an exercise like this. What did you hear in terms of the fluency that you thought General Langley has regarding his understanding of Chinese engagement in Africa? Give us a take of what you heard, and then Judah, I'd like to get your take on that too.
I might sound a bit mean, but when you pay careful attention, I had the feeling that he was giving a talking points to how to answer that question, but without really knowing and understanding how to properly address the question and the issue. And he, of course, he ended up to bring PEPFAR. It kind of threw buzzwords, you know, misinformation, fake news and everything, China, Russia and everything, and he landed on PEPFAR. But in terms of addressing the challenges on how the U.S. can really address China's influence in those space in Africa, he did not really have a substantial answer to give to the senator to really give those strategies. And that tells you how much it just reflects you sometimes the fact that they look everything under the lens of security and the threat against the US, kind of, as I said before, and even Judah said it before, it kind of make them blind to other relevant issues that Africans are facing and they want to be addressed. For instance, as long as they keep on seeing China presence in Africa and China interaction in Africa as a zero-sum game where Africans are saying that we don't want to engage in that geopolitical debate, it makes difficult for them to be heard when Africa say, can you create a platform where we can have cooperation instead of having competitions? Because on the other side, the position is either you're with us, either you're against us. And that's something that I think is quite dangerous and doesn't allow them to really being a part of a solution that address Africa challenge in that space, and even to address to challenge China effectively if they want to, if they say they want to.
Now, to be fair, this conversation is a more security-focused conversation because it is, in fact, the House Armed Services Committee, and these are the generals. So just that to be fair.
Yes, I understand. And this is where, for me, it's kind of, as you said earlier, where you said where you have generals from the army talking about different issues of foreign policies. It tells you how much everything's, it's kind of shaped under security debates. That's the part that's, for me, is a big problem.
I think this is an important piece. And I try to bring this up every time I talk about China's presence on the continent and American presence on the continent. $100 billion over a 20-year period is not nothing. There are somewhere between 20 to 25 million Africans who are on antiretroviral drugs. Everyone remembers, or at least those who are old enough to remember, in the early 2000s, when AIDS was ravaging parts of Central and Southern Africa, PEPFAR was a response to that. One of the largest killers in tropical Africa is malaria. The President's Malaria Initiative, PMI, is a huge reason why that number is lower than it would otherwise be. So American presence, American investment, you have to remember all of this money is grants. Those are in loans that have to be repaid. So there is a substantive American presence when it comes to human capital in Africa. But that is not the only thing Africans need. And Africans do not always want to be in a position where people come to help them. If they can grow their economy, they will provide these things for themselves. They can become markets where American products can be sold. And I think it's that connection that has been missed. All of the things I said about PEPFAR are true. All of U.S. development assistance is true. But that's the economic part. And nobody, no country, no people want to continue to remain a perennial ward of the international system. And when China begins to address that question, the way you grow a functioning economy is to have a functioning infrastructure. And China is available to provide that. That It's what is missing, I think. And I think that's what is being addressed now by your new DFC, Prosper Africa. It's just sort of a wait and see to see how far it will go. But it comes back to Judd's point, right? I took this from Judd and I use it a lot.
Judd, of course, is Judd Devermont, the former National Security Director for Africa in the White House, who is no longer there anymore.
That's right. That America, the United States, wants to be Africa's partner of choice. But Africans, the scale of the continent's challenges and the scope of that mean that there is not a single partner who is capable can meet all of that. So Africa doesn't want a partner of choice. Africa needs a choice of partners, right? So China is going to have a space on the continent because it has unique capabilities. And the United States and Europe will continue to have a space on the continent because they too have unique capabilities. The African governments that manage to balance that will benefit the most from this period of churn and turbulence in international affairs that I wrote about in my piece.
The piece is called, Is There a Silver Lining for Africa in China's Slowdown? Written by one of the smartest guys out there on this subject, Jude Moore, who's a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, but travels widely in Africa and now increasingly in China as well. And he's also host of the just indispensable podcast, Lagos to Mombasa. We will put links to all of that in the show notes. Jude, my head is spinning. Thank you for a fascinating hour of just opening up your brain for us a little bit to see inside and just all of the great things that are going on. It's just so enlightening. So we really appreciate your time this morning.
It's always a pleasure to come here, talk to you, whether it's Cobos or Gerard. I think in this space of thinking and talking about Africa and China, the China-Africa podcast has been really instrumental to me. I mean, it provided me a massive audience of people who hadn't heard of me before or hadn't heard of the things I said and provided me the platform to be able to do that. So it's always a pleasure to come back and talk to you. So thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And we look forward to having you back again after you come back from China next time.
All right. Thank you, guys.
The fundamental point, Giraud, that Jude brought up, that Africans see China so radically different than not only the Americans, but also Europeans do, I think is at the core reason why there's such a fundamental misunderstanding here. That point that he brought up that says, you know, Chad's not going to give a crap if the Chinese want to expand their influence in the South China Sea at the Philippines' expense. That's just not their fight. This is what we've brought up on previous discussions about Xinjiang, Tibet, human rights, Taiwan. This is what I call the Jay-Z rule of foreign policy. I've got 99 problems and Xinjiang is not one of them. And these countries are looking again at their own national interest, and in their national interest, engaging both China and the United States and the Europeans and the Japanese and the South Koreans is the only strategy that makes sense. But yet, so often in the United States framing, it is maybe not explicitly a zero-sum game, but it's definitely implicitly a zero-sum game. And just one final point, I'm reading a book on the history of Patrice Lumumba, who was your former prime minister, very brief tenure of prime minister before Mobutu Sese Seko came into power. And what's so interesting is that the United States was central to all of this. And listening to the discourse in Washington about Lumumba was, again, in this Cold War zero-sum thinking, which is if we don't do something, then the Soviets will. And the Congo lacked a lot of agency in that discussion. What's interesting listening to that 70 years later, I hear hallmarks of that same type of thinking that the United States has. And at the end of the day, we just can't escape our history. And that's just who we are. And that's, I think it's regrettable, but I think if you understand the history of how the United States sees international relations, that zero-sum thinking is very much part and parcel of our history.
Exactly. And as I've been telling you before, I do believe that in the U.S. there is a deep conviction, a deep certitude that, you know, they are the good guys in the history, that the history, the way, whatever story that you're making up, they are the good guys. And everything they put on the table, it's ultimately for the good of them and the good of the world. Kind of at the end, putting us not on the driver's seat, but just on the passenger seat, just waiting for them to tell us where you go. And this is the narrative for me that's kind of becoming patronizing. 70 years later down the line, you hear the same zero-sum game narrative, the same shaping, the same presenting the story. At the end, it becomes so, it's really become, I wouldn't say annoying, but just becomes so redundant. And as Judith said, they have to come to understand that themselves, they cannot solve all problems of the world. They cannot do that. They have to agree that there is a rise of new powers who are becoming option for many developing countries. And those developing countries, they do need those missing pieces between underdevelopment, developing and developed country. And what they don't see is like country like China, Turkey, and all those countries are the missing pieces where African can see that I was poor yesterday and I can become rich tomorrow. And when they see China, China has a story to tell them that, you know, we can go from this poverty to those that much of wealth. But the US being a developed country, sometime it will be quite hard for them to relate, to connect the reality that infrastructure is a big deal for many African countries. As Jude said himself, like it became so basic for them that for them, they don't even consider what $1 billion can do when you build a bridge, when you build a road for African countries. And that's the missing point for me.
Yeah, but I just want to urge you not to be too negative about the United States, because I think the U.S. is in a lot of ways like China. It's a complex actor.
Yeah.
Where we can sit here for the whole show and just crap on the United States and everything we would say would be true, no doubt. But we could also have an equally long discussion where we talked about the fantastic things that the United States has done. Again, $11 billion annually of humanitarian support dwarfs what the Chinese are doing. And again, 25 million people kept alive. So both sit side by side. Just as we talk about the complexity of the China-Africa relationship, we have to apply that same complexity, I think, to the U.S.-Africa relationship. That, unfortunately, though, is not a level of nuance that's brought in the discussion in Washington. We've heard this over and over again, where they don't really want to talk as much about the downsides, but more about the upsides, as we heard from Capitol Hill. But nonetheless, it is a complex actor. So, and again, this is going to be something to watch, how João Lourenço, what we talked about at the beginning of the show, the Angolan president, what he comes away with from his trip. A lot of times the announcements are made, but we don't really get the details until a week or two after in terms of these trips. So we're going to be keeping an eye on that to see what announcements come out of the Angolan president's visits. Giraud seems to think that because the stakes are higher, that he might actually get more than, say, what some of the other presidents, including your own president, Félix Tshisekedi, who largely came home empty-handed from his trip to China, famously last year. So, Giraud, let's leave the conversation there. We could go on for a lot longer. Fantastic to have you back on the show and for the chance to speak with Jude. We're going to put Jude's X handle in the show notes, along with the links to his podcast and that article. And if you want to join Jude and thousands of others around the world who are reading and following the work that we're doing and supporting the work that Giraud does and Johnny in the Middle East and Cobus and all of us are doing, subscribe to the China Global South Project. Not only do you get a fantastic, unique, indispensable source of intelligence and information that's read by thousands of diplomats around the world, including many in Washington, it's also what supports independent journalism. And this is something that's so badly needed in today's world. Really agenda-free, nonpartisan, just down-the-middle journalism. We're just trying to tell the story the best way we can. And so your subscription helps to make this possible. Also, Giraud is managing our Patreon community, and he engages with everybody on Patreon. And we want to put a huge thank you to everybody who supports us on Patreon. Go to the links in the show notes, patreon.com/China Global South or ChinaGlobalSouth.com/subscribe. And if you are a student or a teacher, we will give you half off your subscription. Just email me, Eric@ChinaGlobalSouth.com, and I will send you the links for a half off subscription. Okay, let's leave our conversation there. Giraud and I will be back again next week with another edition of the China in Africa podcast. For Giraud in Mauritius, I'm Eric Olander. Thank you so much for listening.
The discussion continues online. Tag us on Twitter @ChinaGSProject and visit us at ChinaGlobalSouth.com. If you speak French, check out our full coverage at projetafriquechine.com and AfriqueChine on Twitter. That's Afrique with a K. And you'll also find links to our sites and social media channels in Arabic.